You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Not all that long ago, when you went on a vacation, you probably sent a postcard to mom, dad, a close friend. Maybe you grabbed one with a photo of the place you were visiting, wrote a quick note on the back. Maybe "Wish You Were Here" was featured on there, slapped on a really cheap stamp. A few days later, it gets delivered. The recipient gets excited with that fun piece of mail, and they get to read the personalized note. Maybe they even saved it and put it in a box. But now that we have smartphones and easy access to email and social media, are postcards still relevant? Our next guest says yes. She's got a new book coming out on the history of postcards, all the different industries that are involved with making them happen, the role they played in the past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still send postcards? Why or why not? How do you feel when you get them, if you do? Is there a particular postcard you remember sending or receiving? Do you have that treasure trove, a box of your own or someone else's postcards? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia Pine is an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I mentioned that treasure trove, that box of postcards, maybe from a family member. You had one of those, right?
Yes, I started this project with one of those boxes. And since I've been working on this project, have been gifted with several more. Excuse me. It seems that the once family members find out that you're interested in the postcard project, they keep coming. They recirculate, if you will, which is awesome. But yes, my interest in this project really was sparked by having been gifted this box of postcards from the turn of the 20th century, and looking through postcards that my great grandfather had received, and just sort of starting to think about all of the different ways that postcards function as a social network.
You write that postcards are the largest class of artifacts that humankind has ever exchanged. Can you give us a sense of the scope, especially in the heyday of the postcard?
Yeah, it really shocked me to realize just how many postcards have been made and sent and printed and read and received going around the world. So historians estimate that in the first two decades of the 20th century, so 1900 to 1920, something like 200 billion, so billion with a B, postcards were in global circulation. And when I came across that, that really set me back to just think about the sheer amount of work and labor and ideas and technology that go into all of the parts that are required to send a postcard. As you said, we have to find a stamp. We have to have it delivered. We have to print it. We have to buy it and send it, and somebody has to receive it. And thinking about 200 billion artifacts in circulation was really mind-blowing for me.
You dig into the meaning of postcards, what it means that we embrace these and sent them. And there's a tip here in your subtitle, our first social network. Can you talk about that idea of sending these cheap postcards, quick, cheap, easy to send, as a sort of social network?
Yeah, one of the things that has been fascinating to dig into with this project is the idea that there's a sender and a recipient. And it's not just sort of performative tourism of, oh, look, here I am, I sent this postcard, and here's my demonstration that I went to this really cool touristy thing. But there's also the sort of material life of the postcard, that it's received. Some people save them, some people don't save them. And there's this sense that the postcards are forming the lines of networking that I think we reenact over a century later with digital social networks like Twitter and Instagram. The idea that there's a post and that people respond to it, or the idea that that there's an image and that it sort of has this sense, like there's a really good sort of Instagram aesthetic. There were really good postcard aesthetics 100 years before. And so I think that there are a lot of the similar ways that social networks function that we think about today. A lot of the precedents for this were set down by this older social network made up of postcards.
One thing that really struck me, I think of postcards mainly as, you know, the thing you send when you travel. They were big in rural America as kind of this lifeline of communication. Can you talk about how it swept rural communities across the U.S.?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating story. So in 1909, the U.S. Post Office was in danger of going bankrupt. That they were something like $17 million in the red, and it was really quite grim. And 2 years later, in 1911, they're actually running a surplus. They're running something like $200,000 of a surplus. And there's this huge question of, well, what happened? What happened in 2 years that could turn around the postal situation like that? And the historian Daniel Gifford had gone through the postal archives to figure out that it's simply the sheer number of postcards that are being bought and sold and sent through the United States Postal Service at that point. And so, excuse me. And so one of the big ways that this really turned was it was establishing connections between rural people in rural America with people in urban America. And so there is this sort of networking effect that's happening.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book out next week, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, David?
It's kind of neat. I was going through my dad's stuff, you know, right down to the fishing tackle and the last of the stuff. He passed a while ago. And one of the things that was in there, it was a cardboard, I'd call it a can, and it had like a tin top and a tin bottom to it. And I opened it up, and there was a postcard inside, and it said, "Send your used gold here." And, you know, they would buy it back for 35 cents an ounce or whatever. But there was a penny postcard in there, so that had to be like from the 30s or 40s maybe. I just thought that was kind of cool with the penny postcard, though.
Interesting, David. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Lydia, a lot of postcards were sent for personal communication. A lot of them, you write, were for advertising or business schemes like the one David's dad, it sounds like, ran across.
Yeah, if I could just jump in with that. Yeah. I'm so excited that David had that example to share, because certainly postcards were an incredibly cheap form of advertising. And lots of companies did things like that to advertise either personal businesses or to advertise for their company. And it really was fairly ubiquitous. One of my favorite examples that I folded into the introduction of the book was a postcard that was sent out by a church in Kansas that was reprimanding people for not attending services. And so this idea that there's advertising or there's some sort of like, not just, hey, wish you were here. There's certainly that element to postcards as well.
Yeah, our producer Bill Martin's liked to one that you printed saying, hey, we all felt bad you didn't make it to Sunday school last Sunday. Hope to see you next week.
Exactly.
The guilt card. I love it. Thanks, David, for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Madeline in Rice Lake. Madeline, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to share a little story of my parents and I, before I got married, my parents and I took a last trip of me being single, and we went across Lake Michigan in the SS Badger ferry. Mm-hmm. And in the gift shop, they had a thin little wooden postcard. And I thought, I want to send this to my fiance. And it was so cute. I wrote a little letter, and it was such a cute little postcard. I told him, hang on to this, because when we're married and we have our little home, like, I would like to have this as decor. And I have it now in a little cabinet tucked away, kind of cute.
I love it, Madeline. Thank you so much for sharing that. Sentimental value, Lydia, not just for Madeline, but for a lot of people on maybe that particular postcard.
No, exactly. That there really is this sort of resonance in it. And it's not just building any kind of network. It's really building this personal network and this personal connection. And it's sort of like this material manifestation of, hey, here's this thing. And I remember doing this thing. So that's a brilliant example.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the history and the present of postcards with Lydia Pine. She's an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you send and or receive postcards to this day? Do you have fond memories of doing it in the past? Do you have a collection of your own or maybe a family member's in a box? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Hi, Larry Mueller here, inviting you to join me weekday mornings at 11 on the Ideas Network for talk about everyday life. From books to wildlife to sports and history, we cover it all. Even tips for healthy living for you and your pets. We share interesting and inspiring stories from people and places across Wisconsin, and you make the conversation possible. Weekday mornings at 11 on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lydia Pine about her newest book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Fountain City. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
Years ago, a very good friend of mine started a postcard chain letter idea. And he set up groups that you could pick a theme, and you would get postcards from all over the world, all over the country. I got a huge stack of them, and it was a great, fun project.
And, John, have you gotten some ones from around the world?
Oh, yeah, from all over Europe, Africa, Soviet Union in those days.
I love it, John. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Lydia, you have been on a postcard sending mission, I understand, as part of your research for the book.
So, as part of the research for the book, but also just out of, I loved sending and receiving postcards as a kid and decided that I wanted to do the same with my nieces and nephews. Who are thoroughly in the Gen Z demographic. And it was this utter novelty when I started doing it a couple of years ago when I started this research project. And it's been really fun for the kids to receive and to start sending them. That's been the other fun thing to sort of build the network back the other way is to be able to have them start sending some postcards to me as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We had an email from Greg who says his father passed away some years ago, was an avid postcard collector. Greg says he's held on to his collection, not knowing what to do with it, apart from a few he wants to personally keep. He wonders, you know, can you get these appraised? Or can you sell these things or at a minimum donate them so that someone can enjoy them as much as his dad did? There is a collector's market, but there's a lot of postcards out there, right, Lydia?
There are a lot of postcards out there. I know that some public libraries are interested in collections and just sort of building their own picture archives. Some historical associations are interested in building those. Some folks opt to sort of disassemble personal collections like that through eBay or Etsy. So I think that those seem to be the most popular, the popular options for what to do with the collection if you don't want to keep the shoebox.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in New Berlin. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I called in postcards are really important to me. And as an art teacher and an art therapist, I use postcards a lot. But here's one thing. In talking to a friend of mine, we haven't lived near each other since we were 18, but have known each other for 59 years now. And she just told me that she has saved every single postcard and letter I have ever written to her.
Aww.
And so, and I remember writing a lot of those postcards from, you know, family vacations all the way up until taking our kids on family vacations, you know, and I stopped sending them too much these days, but still send them once in a while. So anyway, she's got my life in a shoebox.
Susie, thank you so much. That reminds me, Lydia, a big point you make is, you know, a postcard on a shelf is one thing, but it really becomes something based on, you know, what we do with it, who we send it to, the message we write, and what they do with it when they get it.
Yeah, one of the things that's been really interesting about this project is the sense that I tell people about it, and the first thing folks say usually is, well, does anybody send postcards anymore? And the answer is emphatically yes. People do send postcards. So for example, in the last couple of elections, postcards to voters have been really popular. There are programs that you can arrange to have postcards sent on your behalf. People still send them sort of almost in defiance of fast communication to say, look, here, we can celebrate the slowness of a postcard. And so it's really neat to see people, I think, embracing the qualities that postcards offer. They don't offer the speed of an Instagram post, but they offer sort of that material connection, the idea that here's this thing and it took this effort, and I thought of you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story. We'll go to Amanda next in De Pere. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I like to use the cheesy postcards from the 80s, draw pictures on them, and write jokes for my six-year-old nephew and send them through the mail. And he just loves the surprise when the postman brings it.
Is this something you've been doing over, I don't know, over the COVID time?
Definitely during the COVID time. And he's just learning how to read. He's in kindergarten. So it's a great way for him to practice those letters.
I love it, Amanda. Thanks a lot for telling us about that. Lydia, what do you think of the story?
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that there's a huge historical precedent for it. Not only is it just really cool and an amazing thing to be doing, but you're tapping into this sort of 150 years of postcards to do it.
Thanks, Amanda, for sharing that with us. We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now. We've got Paul with us in Toma. Paul, hello. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, you had a story for us, I think, Paul. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, well, when my son was in Cub Scouts way back in the mid-90s, I started a program, helped him do a program for his national requirement for one of his badges. And what we did is we sent out postcards to all 50 governors and had them sign a card and send it back to us that said, peace through cooperation. It was because back in the day, presidents became presidents either being governors, senators, or congressmen. But as a result, like I said, he got 47 out of 50.
Wow!
And the three, only three of them didn't respond because we were outside of the state. That was back when we were in Louisiana. So,
well, I got to ask: Did you keep those, or did he keep those?
We did for a very long time. Then I became homeless for a while, and I had them with me, and they got lost to the wind. But they were quite the collection. We had Mario Cuomo back in the day, and we had we got a letter from President-elect Clinton, and we got one from the replacement governor of Arkansas, and several of the governors were either died within a year or were convicted. That was kind of.
Thanks a lot. I'm sorry you ran into hard times and had to give those up, but a great story still, Lydia. I love that, writing to public officials and getting responses from most of them.
That's fantastic. I think it really speaks to sort of the ubiquity and the flexibility of postcards as a medium, to be able to have all of these different ways for postcards to be sent and received and to have them intersecting people's lives. I love it.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul. We've got Dick on the line in La Crosse now. Dick, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember postcards. I was a little farm boy in Iowa back in the 50s. And I would get a postcard from my grandparents who would travel to California, and I would get a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, or when they went to Mount Rushmore, it would be Mount Rushmore. And so it was the best pictures I ever saw of those kind of historical figures from throughout the states when they traveled. And so I just thought that was very special to have them think of me, but I also got to see something that they saw that was kind of an icon.
I love it, Dick. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm also glad he called Lydia, because you reminded me. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how places are represented in these postcards that people like Dick's grandparents were sending.
Oh, that's a fantastic segue. And there are two things that come to mind with that. One, certainly there are these famous places like Mount Rushmore or the Brooklyn Bridge or the Eiffel Tower or things like that that become really codified as tourist stops through postcards. It's like, hey, I went to this place and I am going to send you this postcard of this famous thing. But there's also, in the early 20th century, postcards are also serving a role in sort of early photojournalism, where real picture postcards that are basically just pictures that are printed on postcard stock are a alternative or an option for the sort of early days of photojournalism. And so for things like the Mexican Revolution or for political rallies and protests and things like that of the early 20th century, postcards become a way of dissembling and being able to sort of make people aware of places and of things that are happening there.
Just in our last minute, 20 years from now, we're not going to open up that box of Instagram posts. Do you worry that we're losing something if a lot of that kind of a quick communication is in this non-physical form that postcards were?
That's an interesting question. And I would say yes and no. That yes, yeah, certainly, I hope that nobody's printing out my Instagram posts to save the way, I would hope that people would save a postcard. But I also look at how many postcards have been lost, right? That we don't have those 200 billion postcards still with us. And so I think that there will be some things that sort of filter through and are saved. And that's pretty neat.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Pine, affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Love to hear more of your postcard stories. You can share them over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe even you can share a picture of one that you've kept or found in that treasure trove from a relative. Again, you can share that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think we'll have more stories to share later this week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, this may come as a shock to some people, but we are not always in full control of our continued career success. What's that? We can't stay at the top of our games for as long as we want? No, our next guest says no matter how high your career peaks, they are that. They're peaks, heights, and they're going to be followed at some point by a decline. Well, that sounds kind of depressing, but it doesn't have to be if we're willing to change our mindset. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where are you in your career? How are you thinking about what's coming next? Have you made plans or have you fulfilled a plan to have a next chapter after your career, whatever it might have been? Or are you trying to figure that out right now? Are you over 50 and trying to figure out what you want to do when you grow up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Arthur Brooks is William Henry Bloomberg Professor of the Practice of Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Professor of Management Practice at Harvard's Business School. He created the How to Build a Life column for The Atlantic. He's the author of a dozen books. His latest is called From Strength to Strength: Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be with you.
Well, you did a lot of research in this book, but it started very personally for you. What got you started down this path?
You know, I've always thought, and I'm a social scientist and I specialize in the science of happiness, but I was making this one mistake, which is I thought that successful people, they tend to wind up happier than people who haven't done as much with their lives. That people who do big things, they can kind of dine out on it and feel good about it for the rest of their life. But I had this experience some years ago. I was on a plane and I was overhearing a conversation of an elderly couple behind me. And the husband was confessing to his wife that he might as well be dead, that nobody loved him anymore, and that people had forgotten him, and he was so depressed. And At the end of the flight, everybody stood up and I turned around to get a look, and it was one of the most famous men in the world, somebody who had accomplished 10 times what I will ever accomplish in my career in my wildest dreams. And it made it clear to me that, that people struggle. And, you know, the truth is that people struggle more when they've done a lot and those things are finished. I went on to do a little study of how people get happier as they get older. And I found that about half of people get happier and happier from 70 on, and the other half start going back down. And so I started this study to say, what are the habits of the people who get happier as they age? And what can we do to remarkably change the odds of being happier at 75 than we were at 25? And this book is the result. It's the 7 secrets, the 7 habits of what people who get happier in old age, what they all do in common. I think I may have cracked the code.
One recurring theme in the book seems to be the things that might make us successful in the eyes of our peers or of the public don't always line up with the things that make us happy, especially in that later in life era. Why is that?
Well, one of the problems that we have in life is that we're always getting addicted to things that give us momentary satisfaction, whether it's cigarettes or drugs and alcohol or gambling. And one of the things that people who are really hard workers, who are strivers, you know, they've been told by their parents that they're the special one, that they can always do something better than others, is they become what I call success addicts. Success means you're kind of getting the cookie for doing the right thing, for working harder, for getting the grades, for accomplishing. And people get into this pattern quite early in life, and they pursue it well into their adulthood, you know, success to success to success. And it's like being on a treadmill, actually, a little tiny bit of satisfaction, then it wears off, and then there we go again. It's a very dangerous addiction. It's not the secret to doing well. And when inevitably your skills change, I mean, you said in the introduction to the segment that our skills decline, and they do. The problem is that we won't let things decline. We won't let things change. That one of the great secrets to people who actually get happier is that their early skills do decline, but a new set of skills appear if we're willing to let things go. We can be more successful later in life than we ever were earlier in life, but we have to let things go and let ourselves change.
You mentioned 7 keys to finding that happiness later in life. We won't get to all of them today. I want to pick out one since I teased it a little bit there for people. The number one thing seems to be building good relationships. Easier said than done, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's easier for some people than it is for others. But once again, we're talking about people who work very hard and try to do a lot with their lives. A lot of people who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, let's not kid ourselves, who are, you know, doing a lot and they have good values and they're really hard workers. But the result is that they make some sacrifices. I've been working with people and teaching at the Harvard Business School. I see it all the time, of people who basically think that if they get enough career success, then their relationships will take care of themselves. And of course they won't. The biggest problem that people have who are quite successful in life is that they have an enormous number of deal friends, but almost no real friends. And everybody listening to us knows the difference between real friends and deal friends. And so what I wind up doing in this book is talking about what the difference is and how people at any stage in life, at 25 or 45 or even 65, can start building a roster of real friends so they can have the satisfaction that they deserve later in life.
The tricky thing there is if you are thinking, I'm going to optimize my time for success, I'm going to get the most out of every moment, you write in the book, just hanging out with a buddy may not at any given moment feel like the optimal use of time. So it's going to be put off infinitely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that I find is that, you know, real success addicts, workaholic people, they tend to prioritize the 14th hour of work over the first hour with their families even. I mean, it's interesting. I was having a conversation over the course of writing the book with a very successful woman in New York City, a financier, a you know, titan on Wall Street, who's made an enormous amount of money. And she's talking about all the things that are going wrong in her life, that, you know, she feels her skills starting to decline, but she doesn't have relationships very close with her adult children. Her marriage is kind of on the rocks. And I said, well, you're already telling me what you need to do. You need to step back from work and repair these relationships. Why don't you do that? She said, I guess I'd prefer to be special than happy. In other words, she was making a decision that to say that she would, you know, anybody can hang out with their family, but not everybody can run this enormous firm. And she had been making an affirmative decision. This is what all kinds of addicts do. We do this all the time. It's a bad trade.
We're talking to Arthur Brooks about his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bennett is with us in Madison. Bennett, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think that the way this was introduced was a little misleading, and I want to say that just because I agree with the principles that being a workaholic is not conductive to gaining happiness throughout life. But I think that as much as you can control your mindset surrounding what defines your happiness, success can be a healthy contribution to that, and you don't really have to look at a peak in your career as a peak in your career. You're the one who decides when you've peaked and when you want to, utilize new skills to maybe go a different route with your career or what you define as success.
And Bennett, can I ask, if it's not too personal, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Okay. So you're looking at this from the low end. I love that. Thanks a lot for calling in, Bennett, at 800-642-1234. Arthur, what do you think? We can, as long as we define our peaks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, Bennett's got a good insight. And in point of fact, what's happening through Bennett's 20s, going in 20s and even 30s, is an increase in what's called fluid intelligence. You get better and better at what you do. You can work harder and get a big return from it. That fluid intelligence, from the ability to solve problems, usually to answer the questions that other people pose to you, that tends to start decreasing in your late 30s all the way through your 40s. But there's another kind of success that's behind it called your crystallized intelligence, your wisdom, your ability to not answer somebody else's questions, but to figure out what the right questions are, to build teams of people, to teach, to mentor. This gets incredibly strong as you go through your 50s and 60s and stays high in your 70s and 80s. What people don't do is they don't actually craft their life. They want to stay on that first curve because they were good at it, and they kind of rail against the world. They do what Dylan Thomas called rage against the dying of the light. And it's an exercise in futility. You got to be willing to change. That's one of the great secrets of happy people as they age.
Bennett, thanks for that call. Yeah, Arthur, chapter one in your book was about this inevitable decline in what you mentioned, that fluid intelligence. It was really kind of depressing. So I'm glad I kept reading to chapter two, this other kind of intelligence, that wisdom. How do we intentionally shift gears, though?
Well, to begin with, you got to know that second curve exists. A lot of people think that they get one curve. And for the longest time, psychologists talked about different kinds of genius, the early kind and the late kind. The early kind was, sort of your Elon Musk type of genius, and everybody has it. This is not just about rich and famous people or people who are classified as geniuses as kids. Everybody has the capacity to work hard and to innovate and make something with their life. The second genius type that they talked about was kind of the Dalai Lama type of genius. The wisdom, the people, the great sage, call it the David McCullough genius if you want. The people who are able to take complex ideas and boil them down and explain them to others. Well, what we found out much more recently is everybody has both. The key thing is that you get one early and one late. And so the first thing that people need to keep in mind is that they have to trust that they have the second curve. But you can't get on the second curve until you get off the first curve. And that means you have to have confidence that it exists. You have to have the love of other people in your life so that as you start making changes, you don't feel like there's nothing out there for you. And this is one of the things that I talk about. I give basically step-by-step instructions in the book about how to go from one curve to the other.
We're talking with Arthur Brooks, professor of public leadership and management at Harvard. We're talking about his latest book. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you reinvent yourself, shift gears in your career, change your definition of success and happiness at some point? Or do you have questions for our guest about his work in this book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Every Sunday evening, Simply Folk brings you 3 hours of great folk music, from string bands to bluegrass, Celtic, Americana, singer-songwriters, and lots more. For the best in traditional and contemporary folk music, join me, Sheila Shigley, this Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with author, columnist, and professor Arthur Brooks about his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Has the definition of success changed for you over the course of your life, of your career? How about happiness? Can the two go together or do they run into each other? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Appleton. Kevin, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Kevin?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, I've been working in the dairy industry for 32 years. It's kind of middle management jobs. Always trying to get more and more or better, the next step up, impress management, you know, and it just, I put my family on the back burner. I went back to school, you know, I did stuff, and I kind of put my family on the back burner for a lot of years, and now I realize I should have done that. I mean, they're where my happiness is.
Kevin, are you taking a second shot here and spending that time, spending that effort on your family now?
Yeah, I am actually, but unfortunately my arthritis and stuff prevents me from doing a lot of things I'd like to do.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Good luck to you in making this transition now. Arthur, what do you hear in Kevin's story there?
I think Kevin has actually got a lot. He's saying a lot of things that are absolutely right. But more importantly, I think it's incredibly encouraging because he actually recognized what the problem is. Most people, they feel a malaise. They feel a kind of a loneliness who after they've been very successful for a long time and not paying adequate attention to the root systems, the real friendships and the family life that they need. Kevin figured it out, actually. And the result is I strongly suspect that he's going to have a lot of happy years ahead of him. One of the things that I talk to a lot to people who are making this transition to being happier as they age is there's a number of ways to increase the, let's just say that, to bring up the temperature on the family relationships and to actually create these kind of real friendships. And, you know, I've looked into the there's a large academic literature that talks about, you know, the best ways to do these things. Believe it or not, social psychologists have been talking about this for many, many years. And so through interviews and actually looking at the social psychological literature, I talk about the fastest way to do actually just that. But the first step, as Kevin suggests, is recognizing that you don't always make the right decisions. Now, the good news is you can always get on the right train. You can do it when you're 25. You can do it when you're 45. You can do it when you're 65. The key thing is actually doing it, repairing your relationships and growing in love. The happiest people are thinking about their faith and their family life and their friendship. And to the extent that they're really thinking about their work, which is important, is to earn their success, lift other people up, and to serve people who need them.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. A big point you make in the book, Arthur, is people need to know a change is coming. Some kind of decline in one set of skills is probably going to be on the way. And you look at faith traditions around the world and talk about the idea of meditating on the fact that, hey, someday we're going to not do this anymore and people might forget about us. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's absolutely right. One of the reasons that a lot of people are unwilling to let the past go is because they're afraid. You know, fear is terrible. When I talk about love, I talk about love all the way through the book, because the truth is, I'm a professor teaching classes at happiness here in Harvard. And if you can boil down all the things that I teach at the Harvard Business School, is that happiness is love. Full stop, basically. And I've got a ton of data to show that. The problem is that the opposite of love, the thing that crowds out love, is fear. People often think that the opposite of love is hatred. It's not. Hatred is downstream from fear. Anytime I find somebody who's lonely, find somebody who's having trouble finding love in their life, the first thing that I will start to investigate is the sources of their fear. And when we talk about these new stages of life, people are horribly afraid to actually lean into the weaknesses that they have, the strengths that they're actually starting to decline, so they can find the new strengths in their life. That's what the book is called, From Strength to Strength. So the one thing I recommend is that people meditate on the source of their fear. I was talking to my students at Harvard today about the fear of failure. I mean, so many of my students are deeply afraid of failing professionally, failing academically. And so the assignment that I give them is to meditate on what's the worst that can actually happen, to make it less scary, more ordinary, to have it become part of your familiarity. It's most likely not going to happen, but in certain cases, like your own death, there's nothing that you can do about it. You might as well get used to it, and you absolutely can. The Buddhists have been doing this for a couple thousand years, and we can do it too.
Talking to Arthur Brooks about his new book. It is called From Strength to Strength: Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Let's go back to your calls. Ronnie is with us in Cameron. Ronnie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I feel like in the first half, I did a fairly good job raising kids and finding my own satisfaction through teaching and managing Farm and Fleet stores. But now I'm in the second half, and I'm finding I'm retired. I want to go back into production agriculture. I'm doing that, working a couple different jobs. But what I'm also finding is that I'm finding some resistance from my husband, who thinks that I'm not going to have enough saved up for retirement and this and that. And it's caused some conflict. And so I think having, you know, if you have a significant other, having both people agreeing with what the plan should be. And it does create some challenges. So I'd like to know what your guest has to say.
Ronnie, good luck with your new career. Arthur, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Ronnie. And good for you. I like to hear it because you're jumping onto your second curve with both feet. One of the things that I recommend so that people can be on the same page, you know, people who love each other, marriages, for example, that can really function as people change, is to be thinking about the fact that you're going to change and you should change together. Another way of thinking about this is to say, look, we have a 401k for our retirement, but we need a happiness 401k as well. And to make to set up ideas together, to plan out what we're going to do so that together we can become happier people and to make the investments that we actually need. What are the investments in our children? What are the investments in our friend group? What are the investments that we're going to make in each other's professional life so that we can go from strength to strength? And when we see each other as fundamentally invested in each other's happiness, which, by the way, the one thing that all happy married couples have in common is they're working for each other's happiness. The best way to do that I've ever seen is to say, okay, what are the things that we need? What are the deposits that we need to put in our 401k together? And how are we going to do it?
Thanks for that call. Good luck negotiating that, Ronnie. Arthur, I wanted to talk to you about faith and spirituality. You talk in the book about your own Catholic faith. You also learn teachings from religions from India and China. What do you think about the role of faith and spirituality in negotiating this big change later in life?
Well, the role of faith can't be, it shouldn't be underestimated at any stage of life, actually. And this does not necessarily mean my faith. One of the things that I find and that I teach to my students is that the habits of the happiest people at every age, but especially as people get older, are basically fourfold. They're, as I mentioned before, faith, family, friendship, and work that serves other people. And when I say faith, I mean faith or even a non-religious tradition that kind of zooms out on life. And this is the key thing to keep in mind. One of the things that unhappy people have in common is they're very obsessed with the humdrum details of an ordinary life. My job, my car, my money, my friends, my this, that, and the other thing. And it's like watching the same boring television show over and over again. You're obsessed with it, but it can't really hold your interest in a meaningful, happy way. The great thing about studying the Stoic philosophers or developing a meditation practice or like me, you know, seriously practicing your Christian faith, is what that does is it allows you to zoom out on life to see the adventure that actually is life in the transcendent. And everybody deserves to have that kind of adventure.
In our last minute or so, Arthur, can you leave people with maybe a first step to try to shift this mindset away from success and the importance of work to all the other stuff?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing that I find about what all of the successful people have in common is that they have all the things and people and the transcendent in order in their lives. And so basically, this is the key thing to keep in mind. The world's formula for your happiness is all wrong. The world's formula is use people, love things, and worship yourself. And that's wrong. The real formula sounds like that. And so that's why the false formula kind of sounds right. The real formula is use things, love people, and worship the divine. If you follow that formula, you're going to be just fine.
Arthur, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Arthur Brooks, professor of leadership and management at Harvard University. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Still time to share your story. If you are reinventing yourself in your career or figure out what the next step is right now, email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.